It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. While debate over whether or not climate change is real continues in political circles, scientists all over the world are taking what we know about climate change now and using that knowledge to predict how our climate will change in the future. This hour, I'll talk with three Iowa scientists about how predictions are made, how they can be used, and how we can prepare for the future. Gene Talkley is here. He's director of the Climate Science Program and professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. Hello, Gene.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Connie Mutell is here. She's senior science writer at the University of Iowa's IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering Center. Hello, Connie.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And Laura Jackson is also with us. She's director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center and professor of biology at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm excited to be here.
And Gene, I want to start with you because I know that you've done a great deal of work on trying to look into the future, using what we know about climate change to make predictions. You've worked on the National Climate Assessment, which is a document written every 4 to 5 years. Tell me a little bit about how we can use what we know about climate change to make predictions.
Those are very good questions. The climate models that we use now have been widely applied to a variety of different situations to validate what they can simulate with accuracy. And we've looked at past ice ages and so on, and even the 20th century. And we know that these models have skill in certain areas, not all areas, however. So we use them then looking forward. For instance, in a project we've just completed with the Iowa Department of Transportation, University of Iowa, to look at flood frequencies in the future, and with an eye toward using this information for making decisions on how to build bridges in Iowa.
So we're looking toward the future, but it sounds like a very important part of looking at the future is looking at the past.
That's right. We don't have another planet that we can experiment on, so we have to look at the historical record and with regard to details of how good our models are at predicting the water cycle, for instance, as well as temperatures and winds and other climate factors.
Well, and I know the media loves to look into the future and make forecasts. Scientists often don't like to do that because it is so incredibly difficult. Is there a little bit of a push and pull between what people want to hear from scientists and what scientists are willing and able to do?
That's always a tension in our field, because policymakers and planners and would like good information so that they can plan with confidence in making important and very expensive decisions. Climate scientists, on the other hand, scientists in general are rather conservative in the sense of being cautious in not overextending what they know. And so there's this ongoing tension that the demand for more accuracy, but the resistance to overextend what we really are confident in.
Well, Laura, and I know that looking back into the past is something that you have thought about quite a bit as well. And you use the term backcasting. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's something that probably Gene could describe better than I can, but I think it's a really neat way of showing students how modeling works and how you can test your ideas and test how well your model of climate is working by simply trying to predict what happened in the past with your current models. And if you get it right, that means you're kind of understanding what's going on. And if you get it wrong, we've got to go back to the drawing table and tweak this model some more so that we can at least account for what we know happened in the past.
So what you're saying is we can take a computer model that we've generated to predict the future and we can take it back, 50 years, 100 years, and then forecast a future that's already happened?
Mm-hmm. And then check it with what actually happened.
Gene, is that something that you do in your modeling?
It is. And as an example of that, we go back to 1993 when we had this extreme flooding in Iowa. So we go back and look at how the climate models, how well they did, and did they actually predict the kinds of conditions that we experienced. And in fact, they do, and so that gives us some confidence. They don't predict the extremes. They didn't predict an extreme of 9 inches of rainfall in Stratford, Iowa, but it did predict, they do predict that, that we do have these heavy rainfall events.
So, and I think that it's important right now, while we're talking about weather, we're also talking about climate, that we make an important distinction here. And I know that you also work in meteorology, Gene, but when we're talking about climate, we're not talking about weather events, although that's a part of the picture, right?
That's right. And we use the models that we use to predict weather for tomorrow or the next day or the week or rest of the week are almost the same models that we use in climate prediction. So it's if we make improvements in weather prediction, those can be translated also into improvements in climate modeling.
Connie, we've been talking about climate change. Scientists have been talking about climate change, writing about climate change for a long time now. And of course, even before that was the term that we put on it, it was being talked about to a degree. But let's go back, 25 years and look at some of the predictions that were being made 25 years ago. Have we seen some of those predictions already coming true?
Well, yes. Gene might be a better person to answer that, but definitely. I know that I've heard him say that he was creating models in the early 1990s that were correct, really almost to the point with what's happening now. And you talk about looking back and people understanding this in past. I think that people sometimes think, especially people who might be a little bit more cautious about thinking about climate change, that they don't realize that it was in the 1800s already that scientists were understanding the processes that we're seeing unfold now, that that carbon dioxide building in the atmosphere would indeed hold in temperatures, hold in the Earth's heat, and that would have extreme effects on the climate. So this is not something that we've created in the last 10 or 15 years. It's a science that's a couple hundred years old now.
Well, and Gene, can you pick up on that, talking about predictions that have been made, that have come true? What have you seen happen that you and others in your field have predicted would happen?
Connie was a little generous in her comment, I think, on my on the report that she cited. This was back in the late 1980s, and there was a series of models that came out with predictions of what the climate would look like for the U.S. with a doubling of carbon dioxide. And so I picked up and I took those models, and in 1991 published a paper in the Iowa Journal of the Academy of Sciences about climate change in Iowa. Those basic models, one of the outstanding or very dominant factors that they predicted was that the Arctic would warm much more than the tropics. And so much so that I thought these models were way off the chart. Mm. But in fact, that's what we're seeing happening. They also predicted that nights would warm more than days, that winters would warm more than summers, that there would be an increase in precipitation. And so all of those have come true. For Iowa, we're seeing those same predictions come true. I think with regard to the temperature, I think we're seeing precisely what was predicted. On precipitation, the models are not as reliable for simulating precipitation, so I think I was lucky that the precipitation would increase. But the one thing that was very interesting I found, and I didn't realize this until just a year or so ago when I went back and looked at that paper, is that the paper suggested that we would have a change in the seasonality of precipitation in Iowa. That is, we would get more precipitation in the spring and early summer and less in the fall. And we certainly know that that's been happening, and that we have more flooding in the June-July period now than we've had in our historical past.
Well, and you mentioned flooding earlier in the hour. That's been a very important part of your research. I mean, flood events have been really the most significant events in Iowa weather and climate in the last several years. Does your research show that these events are going to be significantly more common?
Well, this was the point of the project that we've just, the pilot project we've just completed, and it was a very successful partnership between the Iowa Department of Transportation, Iowa State University, and the University of Iowa, the Flood Center, which has really good tools to help us understand what happens to precipitation when it hits the ground, because meteorologists are not so good after it hits the ground. So what we did was we looked at what the return periods would be for the kind of floods we've been having. And so the bottom line is that what used to be a 100-year flood in Iowa will in the future be a 24-year flood. So that means that if we're building bridges to last 100 years, if that was our plan, then we've got to rethink how we do that, because the practices we used in the past will get us, on average, only a return period of 24 years. So we'll have to replace bridges on a much, much more frequent interval if we don't pay attention to climate change.
And using the term 100-year flood, was that what the floods of 2008 and the floods of 1993 were? Were those 100-year floods?
Actually, I think they were like 500-year floods.
Okay.
But two 500-year floods in 17 years, you know, that's a little off the chart.
It's significant. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about using climate science to make predictions about the future. With me, Jean Tockley, Director of the Climate Science Program and Professor of Agronomy at Iowa State University. Connie Mutel, Senior Science Writer at the University of Iowa's IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering Center. Laura Jackson, Director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center and Professor of Biology at the University of Northern Iowa. We also want to hear from you this hour. What questions do you have about predicting climate change, about the future of our ecosystems, about what kind of personal responsibility we may have if we can predict the future? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about climate change and talking about how we can use what we know about climate change, climate science, to predict how things will change on our planet in the future and here in the state of Iowa. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, I have three Iowa scientists. Jean Tockley is here, Director of the Climate Science Program and Professor of Agronomy at Iowa State University. Connie Mutel is Senior Science Writer at the University of Iowa's IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering Center. Laura Jackson is Director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center and Professor of Biology at the University of Northern Iowa. And Laura, you work with a lot of students, and I'm curious, when you talk with your students about climate change, does the idea that climate change is affecting us here in Iowa come up very often? It seems like a lot of us think about climate change as something that is happening elsewhere.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, students are, they're paying attention, and they know what the big issues of the day are. And so they have a lot of questions. They're interested in all of this. One of the things we really talk about is prediction and how, you know, if you're predicting something like who's going to win the hockey tournament, and you're correct, you're happy about it because, you know, you were right. For scientists, it's not that way. I mean, I would personally be delighted if these predictions about extinction or climate change turned out to be false and or turned out to be disproved. And most of the climate scientists probably would too. You know, we like to see that our predictions are working because it means we really understand the science. We're really beginning to understand how things really work in the world. But as human beings, it doesn't mean that we're happy when those terrible, terrible things actually come to pass.
Although I'm sure, I mean, Gene, it builds a lot of confidence when those predictions do come true. I mean, it gives you a lot more confidence in looking ahead, right?
It does. But again, we're cautious, but we in how we want to use these models, but we want to be contributing to economic issues and environmental issues so that we make good decisions. So we our goal is to improve these models so that they will be of use to other people.
Well, what I was getting at when I asked Laura that question, when we hear about climate change in many different kinds of media, we're often hearing about ice melting and oceans rising and things that are happening in other places, dramatic things that are happening right now in other places. And there are, of course, there are predictions about what will happen on the coasts of the United States. And we've seen countries with coastlines that are disappearing around the world. What about climate change in Iowa? I mean, Gene, we were just talking about flooding, which is a huge issue in the state of Iowa. What are some of the other things that we're seeing in Iowa that are a result of climate change?
One of the subtle changes that is occurring that most people maybe aren't aware of is the rise in humidity and the rise in nighttime temperatures in summer. We know that Iowa nights can be pretty muggy and kind of uncomfortable in the summertime, and it's really true that our humidity levels have gone up, and these are having impacts on diseases and agricultural pests. The period of dew on crops is longer now than it used to be, and so that's a favorable environment for pests. Our health scientists say that it's also having impact on weeds and other health issues, weeds that are asthma and other health issues. And it's also impacting, in some extreme cases, it's actually reducing the quality of the grain, the corn that we produce.
In what way?
It's reducing the weight in the grain, because at night the crop has to give back carbon dioxide it took up during the day, and the higher the temperature and the higher the humidity that causes that higher temperature, the more weight is lost by the crop. And so the crop doesn't have the volume that it had would otherwise have.
Connie?
Yeah. In addition to that, one of the things that has been shown to be the most statistically significant is the increase in extreme rain events in the Midwest. In the Midwest, they've increased 37% since around 1950. And in the northeastern states, they've increased something like 74%. So these intense early spring rainfalls that we are having commonly now are demonstrated to be a result of climate change. And they're really playing havoc both with our soils, our cropland soils, and with natural areas in Iowa. We have a woodland north of Iowa City, and the erosion there in the last few years has been totally out of unlike anything we've had before. And this is happening with many of our neighbors as well. The creeks are becoming more deeply channelized, banks are caving in, and this is a tremendous stress on many things. And as Gene said also, too, the pollen counts are demonstrated. I think it's something like 22% higher pollen counts here now in Iowa than we've had in the past. So people think about climate change. They used to call it global warming, but it's so much more than warming. It affects everything, and the hydrologic cycle is one of the major things that climate change affects.
So you're seeing dramatic erosion in places that have not been disrupted for agriculture.
Both agricultural erosion and in natural areas that where the hydrology was previously stable, those areas have become destabilized, and this is a major challenge.
Laura, we hear a lot about invasive species in Iowa, and of course, a lot of that is due just to world travel and importing things from other countries and bringing pests along. But does climate change also play a role with invasive species?
It certainly can. There are species that are adapted to more southern climates could begin to start surviving up here. And winter, someone said that, you know, this is the our area is the it's like a party and winter is our bouncer, right? So it's a great party, but winter is a bouncer. So that bounces out a lot of species that otherwise would love it here. So we could expect to see changes in the kinds of plants, insects, other kinds of animals that could survive in Iowa over time as if winters become less less severe. And that just means we're going to have to be on our toes even more. I mean, things are always changing. That's the hard part, is that there's so many different interactions and things are always changing anyway. So it's hard sometimes to single out climate change as the reason for something. And so that's one of the reasons why a lot of the science is so frustratingly cautious, is that we're always having to say, look, you know, we have to be very cautious about attributing this to that, because there are a lot of interactions.
Well, and Gene, I remember about 5 years ago, there was a sort of a restructuring of growing zones in the United States that sort of pushed our zones a little bit north. And so there are plants that didn't used to be hardy in Iowa that are now considered to be hardy in Iowa. I know that's exciting for a lot of gardeners, but clearly that's a pretty significant change, isn't it?
It is, and it has an influence on decisions that horticulturists and landscape planners make in terms of what will flourish in Iowa versus what might not do so well. I know, for instance, I think birch trees are not favored by a real warm soil, and if our soils are getting warmer, this might be adverse to some species like this. So we'll see that some species may be excluded, others may be favored by these kind of changes.
Do you feel like the agricultural community in Iowa is paying attention to climate change?
Farmers are probably some of the best climatologists we have. They are very astute observers. Sometimes they don't, you know, they're not trained in physics, so they may not know some of the reasons behind it, but they pay attention and they remember, because it impacts their living. And so they can remember the bad years and the good years. So that's a good thing. And so many of the farmers that we've talked to are just concerned that, yes, things are changing in ways that they haven't seen in the historical record, or they're seeing things that Grandpa didn't see. And they're making adjustments. They are actually putting in more subsurface drainage tile to get rid of the excess water in the spring and early summer. They're buying larger machinery. John Deere now makes a tractor that you can go 10 miles an hour and plant seeds to rapidly get the seeds planted in a narrower window for planting in the spring. So they are adapting. It's costing them money, but they are seeing that climate change is affecting how they farm.
This hour, we're talking about climate change predictions, using climate science to make predictions about the future. You're welcome to join our conversation. The number to call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Laura Jackson, director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center at UNI, Connie Mutel, senior science writer at the University of Iowa's IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering Center, and Gene Talkley, director of the Climate Science Program and professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. And we were talking about how, with invasive species and just other things that can grow in Iowa as climate changes, and Gene brought up the idea that maybe some of the species that are native in Iowa will not continue to thrive in this state. Is that an area of significant concern? Laura, I know plants are your specialty. Is that a concern about the plants that you study?
Well, it is. Any time, plants are very, very sensitive to to climate. They can't just stand up and walk somewhere else. So they're very sensitive to the conditions that they happen to live in. So for any kind of plant, the climate is a central feature of their adaptations to survival. This part of the world is maybe a little bit less sensitive to that sort of effect than others. We have plants here that establish themselves, as populations 5,000 to 8,000 years ago when the climate was much hotter. So we have plants that are warm adapted. We have plants that were here during the last ice age that are cold adapted. And so we kind of, because of our crossroads with the glaciers coming and going, we have a lot of species that have wide distributions and are broadly adapted to a range of conditions. But there are other parts of the world that are much, much more sensitive. So this recent paper that came out in Science, they showed that, for instance, the rates of extinction in South America, New Zealand, Australia might be, 15% to 25%, whereas the rates of extinction in North America and Europe might be 5% to 6%. So some places are more susceptible to extinctions than others just because of the geography and the types of species that are there.
Connie, you wanted to weigh in on this.
And what we're talking about with the species needing to possibly move to a better climate or a climate that's better suited for them is really the destruction of their habitat and their habitat changing. But I think there are a few other things to think about when we talk about what's happening with nature and climate change. And one is just simply the physical stresses. I mean, if you think about animals and plants that need to withstand the flooding that's now going on or the extreme winds that we're having, the greater turbulence in the atmosphere, the birds that are migrating across the Gulf of Mexico trying to withstand an extreme storm that's happening. But another thing that maybe is a little bit more complicated, excuse me, is a disassembling of the complex interactions among species. And a very graphic example of that is what's happening to the moose up in Minnesota. The population of moose there is declining rapidly. And that's because the moose can't live in the warmer summers, but also because the shorter winters allow more ticks to survive. And there's a phenomenon there now called the ghost moose. Up to 100,000 ticks on a single moose, basically bleeding the moose to death, and the moose tries to rub off these ticks and rubs off its fur in the process, and eventually simply dies. So this is something that's a major event that's happening now, which has been correlated specifically with climate change.
With an instance like that, I mean, a phenomenon like the ghost moose, do you feel like when something like that happens, we're doing a good job of putting that in the bigger picture, or do we tend to isolate these events?
Well, I think that people interested in conservation have always realized you take the megafauna, the animals that stand out, and you use that as an example. So this is a big example. It's something that people care about. But I do think that in Minnesota, if you look in Minnesota news, they're very aware of climate change because it's happening more rapidly there. The temperatures are rising more rapidly, and they are putting it into the bigger picture, yes.
Do you think that because Iowa's landscape is so incredibly altered, and we have natural places, we have beautiful natural places, but we don't have as many as, say, Minnesota. Do you think that obscures a little bit of the vision of climate change for Iowans, Connie?
Well, it may in terms of what's happening with nature, definitely. People who like to do trout fishing, for example, are probably very aware that the trout won't be able to survive in warming streams, but that's a very small population.
And Laura, do you have anything to add on that subject?
Sure, yeah. One of the things that's going to complicate species responses to climate change is the patches of habitat are so far apart. Let's say they are able to migrate through, dispersal, through birds flying or, toads hopping or plants dispersing their seeds, they've got to disperse a long ways to get to the next suitable habitat patch. So while past climate changes have, when the glaciers retreated and the climate warmed up pretty rapidly, species were able to follow those changes in climate because they had extensive reaches of habitat to migrate through. But that's not the case anymore.
Because we have these habitat islands. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about predicting climate change this hour. With me, Jean Tockley of Iowa State University, Connie Mutell of the University of Iowa, and Laura Jackson of the University of Northern Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about using climate science to predict climate change, to look ahead into the future. With me, I have three Iowa scientists: Jean Tockley, director of the Climate Science Program and professor of agronomy at Iowa State University; Connie Mutell, senior science writer at the University of Iowa's IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering Center; Laura Jackson, director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center and professor of biology at the University of Northern Iowa. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Matt is on the line from Floyd. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is for Laura, relating to the relationship, the ecological relationship between insects and prairie. And one thing that we've seen here is with the reduction in the Asclepias family or milkweeds, the reduction of monarch habitat. Are there any other concerns about the reduction of prairie and our loss of insect diversity that would be that we need to really address? Here in the near future, so that we have good diversity in the state as far as both plants and insects.
That's sure. A great question, Matt. Laura?
Yes. Well, yes. Wonderful question. We really do need to think about those little insects as so important to our lives. They're pollinating specialty crops. They're pollinating wildflowers. That's what makes seeds and. The interactions between the plants and the animals that they work together with are delicate, and climate can disrupt those. So there are cases where an insect emerges too early in the spring to pollinate the plant that it's supposed to pollinate, or vice versa. And so specialist insects like the monarch or the regal fritillary butterfly are very sensitive to the plant community that they're dependent on. So more habitat restoration will help us to be more resilient to climate change. Habitat restoration, diverse prairie species will help to stabilize soil and stop soil erosion. Iowa State has a wonderful project working with prairie strips on farms where they take 10% of the land out of prairie, out of the crop. And then they use this terrace-like strip of prairie to trap the soil and the nutrients that are moving, and it also provides it absorbs more water into the groundwater, and it's providing habitat for plants and animals. And at the Tallgrass Prairie Center, we've been helping with this and working with farmers and sharing the knowledge that we've learned from working with roadside managers, county roadsides across the state, and transferring some of that technology and that knowledge about prairie restoration to habitat restoration on farms. And it's a wonderful way to help create more resilience to climate change and support some of those insects like the monarch butterfly that are really challenged right now.
Matt brought up the monarch, and every time I hear about the monarch, I wonder to myself, you know, this is an insect that we all care about because it's beautiful, because it's visible, because it's something that we think about when we think about our childhoods, and everybody loves monarchs. what other species is this happening to at the same time that we don't care about, that we don't think about fondly, and that are invisible to most of us?
Yeah. Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Because only big things that we notice get money for research. So if it's tiny and it's not an economic of obvious economic or cultural importance, there aren't very many people out there that are doing science for free that can just afford to go and monitor each and every little critter that walks and crawls. So we kind of have to use these species like a flagship species or an indicator. We simply don't have enough money or time or scientists to track all the different organisms that would live in a prairie or on a roadside, and so there's a lot of guessing. We do know that honeybees are in trouble, and we suspect that many other kinds of pollinators are in trouble as well. But it's really hard to find a funding agency that will be able to support the kind of detailed science that's necessary to corroborate that suspicion.
Connie, you have something to add?
Yeah. What Laura says is so very true. We need more people out in the field. And I wanted to encourage people to consider citizen science projects. These are so important. What you basically do is become a scientist and report data on a given species or group of animals or plants to a central website, which then puts together the bigger picture. And there are a number of these citizen science projects that anyone can do. Kids, you can involve your kids, your grandkids. One big one is Project Budburst, and it's being done across the country, where people simply send in the dates of the earliest leafing or flowering of a given plant species. The National Wildlife Federation has a wildlife watch. Our Iowa DNR has programs for citizens monitoring frogs and toads. I think they're about to start one for monitoring bats. Butterflies, they have their big butterfly count. There are programs for monitoring birds. And these are wonderful ways not only to get your kids and your grandkids and yourself out in nature, but also to contribute to something. And I think that people sometimes feel hopeless with climate change. I think that getting out and actually doing something positive is one way to fight that feeling of hopelessness.
I wonder, with species in Iowa, again, I mentioned earlier, I mean, Iowa has such an incredibly altered landscape. And through European settlement, so many of the species in Iowa were extirpated. And we've seen some amazing comeback stories in the last 30 or 50 years. Do those successes obscure our vision of how climate change could be impacting these species? Connie, you look like you don't want me to ask you that question.
Well, I thought about that. The Audubon Society has a massive report on birds that I think came out in 2013, maybe last year. And they say that of the 588 species of North American birds, a little bit over half of those are going to be climate threatened by 2080. And something like 126 of those total species will be climate endangered by 2080. And one of those that's climate endangered is the bald eagle, which really surprised me because the bald eagle has been one of those species that have come back in such a major way. So, I think we're going to be seeing new things that we don't expect, that maybe we can't predict. And one of the big things that's a little bit scary about climate change is that we don't know. We've never been here as a species before. We've never walked through a massive change in our world the way we're seeing now. So we're going to be facing things that we don't know about.
A few weeks ago, I talked to Bill McKibben, who has written a great deal about climate change. And I asked him if he still felt like it was part of his role to convince people that climate change is real. He told me that he doesn't feel that's part of his role anymore because he feels like the people who deny climate change are not going to be convinced no matter what kind of science you present them with. Gene, I'm curious about your take on that. Is helping people understand and accept what we know about climate change. Is that part of your role?
Well, it is to a certain extent. Of course, when we're dealing with some climate deniers, we're dealing with a conflict of ideologies. And that's in those cases, you can't really convince on the basis of logic and scientific reasoning. But I think that the one of the important things to recognize is that we need to understand how climate science needs to be considered in major decision making. And Abraham Lincoln established the National Academy of Science in the 1800s to inform the Congress and the nation on matters of science. And the National Academy exists today, and they function that they provide that function very effectively. And they've weighed in on climate science, they have approved the 2014 National Climate Assessment that's just recently been issued that outlines these. So for decision making, which normally we don't think about ideology as being a major factor in economic decisions, but so we need to for those people that are making major decisions, they ought to consult what the National Academy is saying about these matters.
When I read about climate change and the things that are happening, I often feel depressed and helpless, because I feel like there's nothing I can do that can really make a difference. Gene, when you're communicating with people about what is happening with our climate, what do you feel like it's important for people to know so that they understand it, but also so they don't completely shut down and think, I just can't think about something that's so overwhelming?
That was a major consideration among the authors of the National Climate Assessment, is that we need to, when we give our elevator speeches, we need to ensure that we are pointing out that there are things Americans can do and that we have made success, have had success in some aspects, like the conversion to compact fluorescent light bulbs. The conservation, energy conservation is job one for all of us. And the more we can do in that arena, the more we can contribute to getting a handle on climate change, the climate mitigation side of it. So looking for ways to drive less, to use less energy is something that all of us can do. And as Connie points out, becoming citizen scientists, we become more aware of the importance of this, and so we can be more effective in communicating with others about this. We should also be mindful that in Iowa we have a huge wind energy industry, which is really one of the shining stars of our state in terms of its response to the need for renewable energy.
I understand what you're just saying, but when I look at some of the predictions that you see in the media, like global carbon dioxide emissions will increase 43% by 2035 if major nations remain tied to existing energy policies. That's from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. When I see things like that, I think, what difference does it actually make if I drive less? Why should I make personal sacrifices when we have government policies that are sending us into this future? I mean, Connie, I'm sure you struggle with that sometimes.
I struggle a great deal with that. And the thing that I've come down to is that there is a bottom line that we need to communicate to people, and that is that we still have choices. At some point, that won't be the case anymore. If we go beyond certain tipping points, we will be sitting around and watching geological revolution occur in front of our eyes. But at this point, we people, and particularly we people here in the United States, are determining the fate of the climate for the next hundred, thousand, thousands of years. And I think that can be an empowering message to give to people. And I think that what I try to do is to say, this is a time that's exciting. It can be empowering. It can be positive. We can get things done. We know that we have the technologies to solve climate change. We know that it can be done within our current economic structure. What we don't have is the will to do it, and especially the political will. So I think in addition to becoming stewards of our own carbon footprint, we need to exert political power to get national as well as personal or local efforts going.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Jean, how far into the future do you think it's important to look, and how far can we look?
We need to be looking at on a variety of scales. For instance, as I mentioned about bridges, they have a lifetime. We'd like to think they would last 100 years. And so our roads and bridges, we want to be able to make decisions on best available science that takes us out as far as we can see with our models. Other decisions are more short-term, the next couple of decades, which I think are going to be very critical. And so we scientists now are really focusing on that to try to understand the role of natural variability in relationship to global climate change in determining how much our climate is going to be changing, and also on a more regional and local basis.
Connie, it sounds like you do not believe we've passed the point of no return. Some people do think we've passed the point of no return. Jean, what's your take on that?
I tend to be an optimist, and I think Connie rightly points out that we have these decisions, and we have when we look, for instance, at Denmark, which is has a goal of going carbon neutral by, I think it's 2030. I think that's a tremendous inspiration. And actually, with our wind energy here in the state, we're on a track to actually match some of the goals that they have. So I think there is reason for hope.
Laura, I'll let you have the final word. What do you think about the future? Do you feel optimistic?
Well, I don't think any generation who's had an enormous challenge has necessarily volunteered to take that on. So World War II, the Civil War, any major event in history, you know, the generation that was confronted with that challenge, you know, I'm sure many people would just rather duck and just live their lives. But they did take it up. They did take up the challenge. They did make history, and we can do that too.
Laura, thank you so much. Laura Jackson is director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center, professor of biology at the University of Northern Iowa. Connie Mutel, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure.
Connie Mutel is senior science writer at the University of Iowa's IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering Center. And Jean Tockley, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Jean Tockley is director of the Climate Science Program and professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.